Genesis 33 will be our topic of study tonight, but I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 32, verse 9, as you're turning. And remember that Jacob is a man in this context that is absolutely petrified. He's filled with dread, and he's filled with fear, and that's for good reason. His brother Esau is approaching with 400 men. And of course, he doesn't have a good history with his brother Esau. 20 years ago, Esau had been so angry that he was intent upon murder. He's intent upon killing his brother. And Jacob had to tuck his tail between his legs and run. Why was Esau angry? Because Jacob had manipulated the birthright away from his brother using his brother's stomach, and he had deceived his way to get that blessing by some excellent acting with all kinds of stage hands and even costumes. It was quite a performance that he put on. In fact, he had reduced Esau, his own brother, to pleading tears. Remember what he said? "Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father." And he's pleading for something. No, blessing is spent. It's been given to Jacob. And he will be blessed. So Esau was very angry. That was 20 years ago. And in Jacob's mind, that murderous intent would have only heightened and only gotten worse in the last 20 years. So he's very afraid to see his brother. And of course, he now realized, having dealt with Laban, how it felt to be on the other end of deception for 20 years. So he knew what that felt like now, and so his own heart was also not only fearful, but guilty, and filled with shame, and his conscience is bothering him, and all of this is wrapped up in this passage. And so I do believe there's a part of Jacob that wants to make things right, wants reconciliation, and wants his conscience eased as well as we come to this passage. So I want you to look at the prayer to the Lord in chapter 32. So in his fear, he prays to the Lord. Verse 9, Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, 'Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which you have shown to your servant, for with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he will come and attack me and the mothers with the children. For you said," he repeats again the promises of God, you said, "I will surely prosper you and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which is too great to be numbered." And so Jacob prays, and we're meant to remember that prayer heading into chapter 33. But we're also meant to remember that Jacob is a man with a heart that prays and a heart that fears, a heart that postures, a heart that doesn't understand grace, a heart that's not ready to see his brother. But he's begun to be made ready by an amazing event that happened at the end of chapter 32. Do you remember that event? Here he is. Everybody's passing before him. He's left alone. It's dark out. Can't see a thing, and a man attacks him. He thinks it's probably one of Esau's emissaries. And he wrestles with this man all night. And along the way, he begins to discern that this is not just a man, that this is someone else. We learned in other places that it is the Son of God who appeared as man. It is the angel of the Lord, the pre-incarnate Christ, as it were, wrestling with Jacob all night long until the sun begins to rise. And then the angel of the Lord dislocates his hip. And so he's unable in his own strength to fight any longer, and he's reduced, as Hosea chapter 12 tells us, he's reduced to tearful pleading and clinging to the Son for blessing. And he will not let go. He's not wrestling anymore. He's clinging with tears, Hosea tells us, clinging, and he's discovering what grace is. It's clinging. It's not wrestling with God. It's clinging to Him in hopelessness. And of course, at that moment, he's called not the deceiver, but his name is changed to Israel, God's fighter. There's a momentous event for this man, but he doesn't get a whole lot of time to think about all that he's learned. He doesn't get to consider the word and meditate on it because it's day, and guess who's there? Esau. He's there. So here's Jacob. He's half-baked. He's just like us, half-baked, but still in the oven as a believer. He's a Roman 7 kind of a guy. As one has said well, quotes, though he became Israel, he is not upright Israel, but throughout chapters 32 and 33, uptight Israel. And Jacob will learn that only God's grace through prayer, only God's grace accessed through prayer, not the flesh, overcomes fear, bringing impossible reconciliation. Impossible reconciliation. It's an incredible passage. So many things we could, so many directions we can go. Let's see if we can get through it all. I got to go quickly. Verses 1 through 3, we see when fear assaults grace. When fear assaults grace. Take a look at the text. Genesis chapter 33. Now, Jacob, again, doesn't have much time to grow in grace and knowledge of his Lord Jesus Christ. As the sun rises, Esau is upon him, and so is his fear. Just like Esau, his fear is there. The fear of man comes flooding back. Proverbs 29:25. The fear of man is a snare. But whoever puts his trust in the Lord is safe. And so as we look at Genesis 33, look for a man who has been changed into Israel. He is growing. Look for evidences of growth and call that Israel, but know that Jacob is in there too. He's in there. And we can all relate that we are both Jacob and Esau at the same time. Look at verse 1. I want you to see both here. Then Jacob lifted his eyes and looked. Behold, Esau was coming. 400 men with him. So he divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two maids, and he put the maids and their children in front, and Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph last. But he himself passed on ahead of them and bowed down to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. So there's a mix here. There's some Israel in this passage, even in the first 3 verses, and there's some Jacob here. What do you notice about something that may not play very well for half of his kids? I mean, come on, it's no fun when you're the kid, you get stuck in front to get slaughtered. There's favoritism here. He's still dealing with some of the flesh here. However, he planned on coming last, and now we see him in bold courage. He goes up in front. And so there's some new things happening in Jacob's heart, but there's still the old Jacob here as well. And I want you to know, as we see him calling Esau's servant, I'm your servant, and bowing down to him, it's not all good. It's not all a good thing. Because the promises are such that he knew who he was in the promises of God, and he was no servant of Esau. It was the other way around. He was no one that needed to bow down before him. And so, yes, there's some humility here, and he's trying to save his neck, but this is still Jacob trying to earn grace in front of his brother. And so there's humility, there's panic here. There's favoritism and there's courage here. There's Jacob and Esau all over this passage. Both. And we can all say, you know, that's me. That's me. Well, let's look at verses 4 through 11 now, when grace overwhelms fear. Okay, fear assaults grace, and now grace overwhelms fear. Esau is now before him, and he's thinking, I'm going to lose my head. This is the end. Look at verse 4. Now, again, this is a shocking thing. He himself went before, bowing down 7 times. Verse 4 is an absolute shocker. Verse 4, then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. I mean, Jacob has been worrying about this for a long time. And this is what happened. It's an incredible passage. This is Esau's response. What a tender scene between brothers. It's reconciliation due to God's grace. It's unbelievable grace. In fact, it's so unbelievable, Jacob doesn't believe it. He doesn't live in light of it. He still thinks he's got to pad the grace, earn the grace, secure the grace, work out for grace. We do that a lot as Christians, don't we? I mean, incredible grace is given. It's done in verse 4. It's over. Chapter 34. Here we come. No. It's the rest of the chapter. Look at verse 5 through 7. What would you do next? I mean, if this incredible grace happened to you, how would you feel in light of the 400 men, and what would you do next? Now, let's be honest. What would you do? Think of that person who is your Esau. What would you do? Get your $20 bill out. I mean, right? Let me pay this guy off. Let me make sure. I mean, it's human nature to not believe it. This is too good to be true. You see. Okay. So I think some of this is happening. Let's see. Let me read it and see if you can see this. Verse 5, he lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children and said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. If I keep calling him servant, maybe he'll forget that Daddy-O said that he would serve me. If I give him back his blessing, drove after drove after drove after drove with explanation. You see. The children whom God has graciously given your servant. Then the maids came near with their children and they bowed down. Leah likewise came near with her children and they bowed down. And afterward Joseph came near with Rachel and they bowed down. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? What do you mean by all this? He said, to find favor in the sight of my Lord. Well, Jacob is still working his plan to win his brother, bowing all over the place. He sent all the droves. Now, Esau is kind of, I just want to weep. I'm just happy I found you. I'm just glad we're back together again. Esau has forgiven him. There's no grudge. There's no protocol. There's no ancient Near Eastern protocol for Esau. So 7 bows for 7 brothers. It is only Jacob. Maybe it's not protocol. Maybe he's worried. Jacob is cautiously optimistic, but he wants to secure this grace. He's still a lot of fear. There's still guilt fueling his actions. And Esau says virtually, hey, it's not necessary, brother. Verse 8. And he said, what do you mean by all this company which I have met? What do you mean by this? What are you trying to do? And I like Jacob. He's at least honest here. I'm trying to buy forgiveness, okay? He just says it. To find favor, that's the word grace. It's used time and time in this passage. Same word for gracious here in the Hebrew. To find grace in the sight of my Lord. Verse 9, but Esau said, I have plenty, my brother. I have plenty. What do you mean by this? I have plenty. Let what you have be your own. But no, Jacob, needs to give back some of the blessing. He wants to make restitution for earlier wrongs. There's part of it's humility, part of it's not understanding grace and not trusting God. He wants to cement the reconciliation. Verse 10, Jacob said, "No, please, if now I have found favor in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably. Please take my gift, which has been brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Thus he urged him, and he took it. And so he's giving this huge gift. He's trying to get everything solidified and seal the deal. And Alan Ross, I believe, is correct. All the bowing and the use of the language of a servant to his Lord shows an attempt to downplay, if not nullify, his status as Esau's Lord. To get away from what God had said and what Daddy had said. And if it was just protocol, Ross says, it's significant that Esau did not bow but embraced his brother, in quotes. So I think that Jacob's still struggling here, trying to scheme in the flesh, earn grace, doesn't understand grace, struggle receiving grace. He worries that God's work here may not be lasting, and he attempts to add grace to bolster God's work. Now, he has some growing to do, but he does recognize grace when he sees it. Doesn't Jacob, in this passage? Jacob recognizes grace when he sees it. Look at verse 5. "The children that God has graciously given to your servant." Look at verse 11. "Because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have plenty." Verse 10. "No, please, if I have found grace in your sight, then take my present from my hand, for I see your face as one sees the face of God, and you have received me favorably." And so Jacob does connect this reconciliation with his brother with what just happened to him with the angel at Peniel when his name was changed. He makes the connection. He was prepared. You think he's handling this poorly? He's doing pretty good. And so he's dealing with seeing the face of God. He can't believe, "I saw the face of God and I'm not dead." This is kind of like that. I see the face of... Seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. I saw the face of God, somehow I'm alive to tell about it. I see your face, I can't believe I'm still standing here. That's what he's saying. He's like, "I am thrilled. I can recognize grace, I can receive in it, but I can't rest in it, and I can't put my confidence in it. I've got to depend at least partially on my presence and my words and my actions and my plans." And this is the same mixture that we live in now as believers. It's hard to live in grace. It's hard to trust grace. It's hard to trust prayer. You've got to figure it out. But when you read verse 4, read it again. What are your thoughts here for a second? What are your thoughts about Esau? Look at verse 4 again. "Then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept." What are your thoughts about Esau? Why don't you go ahead and answer that? What are some of the things that come to your mind? Are you reading that? What are your thoughts about Esau? Yeah, it's a change there. What else?
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. Yeah, there's a change in heart here. He's actually not longing to murder him, but longing to be reunited to him. Anything else that comes to your mind? Now, I think there's something amazing here. I think it's really easy a lot of times to say, you know what? Esau, what a guy. What an amazing guy. Look at this guy. He's a great guy. He's a changed man. I mean, it kind of stinks when the world behaves like that and the Jacobs behave like this. Am I right? Come on. Kind of stinks. It's true. Esau looks like the good guy here. But I want you to see something. This is not about Esau. This is about the power of God. And this is about the power of prayer. This should not be You say, well, how did it happen? Well, I don't know what millions of providences and millions of this and millions of ways God answered that prayer, but here is something impossible. It's God, and it's His grace that we are to see. This kind of reconciliation is an answer to prayer. It's so impossible. We're meant to see that this is God. God is intervening here to protect Jacob and his seed, the seed of the woman, to preserve His promises of a great nation and a blessing to that nation, of that nation, to all the nations and the seed of the woman, the Christ. He is preserving the Christ by grace. Incredible grace. And all we can see sometimes is what? Esau, what a guy. Oh, I understand that. What a guy. But Esau, and I find it disturbing that Esau is the hero here. But let me say something about that. Esau never mentions grace one time. He looks like a great guy. He lacks one essential ingredient: faith. Esau looks like the better man, as I mentioned. But Jacob mentions grace, what, 4 or 5 times. Who's thanking God here? Jacob. Jacob recognizes that God is all over this. God has done it on nothing. But he's still, yes, he's trying to secure more grace. He's trying to pad grace. He's almost ruining grace. But yet, Esau is a faithless man yet. This is the power of God. You don't believe in common grace? Not until verse 4. If verse 4 doesn't convince you of God's power to do what He will, to move the heart of a king where He wills, God gets the glory here. Esau's as lost as can be. There is no faith here. None. There's no understanding of grace. Poor Esau. I mean, he's such a good guy. He's, by verse 8, he's going, huh? What are you doing this for? I thought we were good. Verse 4, I thought... Well, I think we're brought here not to how good Esau was, but back to the power of prayer and the fact that we can lean on God and His grace, and we can go to Him in prayer, and we can lean on His promises without panic, without posturing, without fear, trusting God to protect us through these impossible relationships. Trusting in His grace. We pray to a God who can do absolutely anything. And we tend to be like the disciples were when they said, we're going fishing. And they did it apart from Christ and apart from His will. Apart from me, you can do what? Nothing. And the sooner we realize that, and Jacob was learning. He learned to stop wrestling and start clinging. And his name was changed, but he still hasn't got it figured out yet. Anybody there? But he was learning and he was being prepared by that grace. Pink is right. Let us seek grace to learn this important lesson that not only are all our fleshly plannings and efforts dishonoring to God, and that they are quite uncalled for and unnecessary, but also that in the end God sets them aside as they accomplish nothing. So God's grace overwhelms this whole passage right in verse 4. But we still see poor Jacob doing his thing. Now, it doesn't get any better for Jacob in this passage. Okay? We see more evidence here. He takes a pretty significant step backward. And the next title, you could say, When Grace and Fear Coexist. Look at verse 12. Esau's super excited. He is thrilled. I want my family. Let's get the families together. Let's travel together. It's going to be a road trip. It's going to be fun. See what I have on my mind. Verse 12. Then Esau said, let us take our journey and go. And I will go before you. Let's go. But he said to him, so Jacob says to him, my Lord knows that the children are frail and that the flocks and herds which are nursing are a care to me. And if they are driven hard one day, all the flocks will die. Please let my Lord pass on before his servant, and I will proceed at my leisure according to the pace of the cattle that are before me, according to the pace of the children, until I come to my Lord at Seir in Edom. I'll go with you, but just let me take my time. You go, you get out of sight. Well, come on. They're not really dying. He's exaggerating and he's deceiving and he's lying straight up. Jacob never intended to go south to Seir. He's trying to get rid of Esau. I will follow you, brother. But did he? No, as soon as he was out of sight, he went the opposite direction. What do you think Esau thought when he discovered Jacob didn't follow? That? He hasn't changed a bit. Well, think about how we rationalize our actions. I think Jacob could have spoken the truth in love and trusted God. Kent Hughes, I think, is right. Jacob rationalized that, well, one day he might actually go to Seir. Don't you? I do that. I might actually eventually do that. You know, it's so ironic in this text. Remember the 400 men that really caused so much fear? Esau says, I will go before you. The 400 men were actually meant by Esau not to slaughter Jacob, but to protect him this whole time. Think about it. They were meant for his protection. So Jacob's decision, I think he's taken a step backward, as I said. I think that he's taken another step backward in this last section. So let's look at it. Look at verse 15. Esau said, please let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, what need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built for himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the place is named Succoth. Now, first of all, Jacob didn't intend to go to Seir. What else? Well, if you look at your Bibles, you know, the maps in the back, you realize that Jacob goes across the Jabbok and he settles in a town outside of the land, for crying out loud. He doesn't even go into the promised land. So here he is. He deceives his brother. He doesn't go down south. And he decides to go, takes another step back. He doesn't enter the promised land. He's supposed to. And it's not just an overnight because he's tired and he's got to stay because he's on a trip. No, he built a house, the text says. And booths for livestock. There's deceit. There's delay. And there's more here. Look at verse 18. Now Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. Now he finally gets there. And when he came from Paddan Aram, he camped before the city. He bought the piece of land which he had pitched his tent from the hand of the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected there an altar and called it El Eli Israel. And Jacob bought land there. He settled in the land. Now, God had commanded him back in Chapter 31 and verse 3, then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will be with you. Some say that he should have been going to his relatives and meeting them in Bethel. I am the God of Bethel. I'm not sure about that, but he's supposed to go down and get with his family. And he goes, it takes him a while to get in the land, and then he doesn't go, he goes right in the land and he stays up north. He doesn't obey. Jacob is obeying halfway here. He doesn't obey all the way. And there's ominous foreshadowing of the next chapter, the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father. Now, if you know anything about your Bible, you know that Genesis chapter 34 is one you'd almost wish to skip. This is the result of halfway obedience. But here he is. He is Jacob. He is Israel. He does love God. He does worship God. He gives God praise. He builds an altar. The God of Israel is a strong God, is what that means. A God who keeps His promises. Indeed, He has a people. He's got all those kids. He's got possessions. He's back to the promised land. But He lingers outside the land. He settled in Shechem. He's supposed to go to this father's house. This is partial obedience. You know, I think we oftentimes come to worship and we can build our altars and we can say the right words and we can worship and we can look real good. And we can even receive God's grace and we can thank Him for it and we can recognize it in our lives. But there's a whole different story between receiving God's grace and resting in God's grace. It's a whole different story. To be privileged to have special experience of grace and understanding of God is quite different than to live in the power of it. It's a whole different thing. It's a whole different thing. It's a tragedy when haunting fears and deception and halfway obedience are our response to God's grace. It's tragic. But oh, how difficult it is to hear about God's grace and to experience it and to live in it. It's so easy to hear about it and to even rejoice in it, but to actually add faith to it. Esau had no clue about faith. Jacob, he is little faith. And without faith, it is impossible to please God. Barnhouse says Jacob's name was changed from Jacob to Israel, but it might well have been from the rest of the book through Jekael or Israel. He was half and half. He combined the two words for Jacob and Israel to illustrate the reality that the rest of the book, we have a combination of Jacob the deceiver and God's fighter. We find both of them. In reality, this passage is all about God's grace, His incredible, overwhelming grace through answered prayer. That's what it is. In knowing what grace is not wrestling in your own flesh, but clinging and waiting for God to bless you, holding on to Him and trusting Him. Overwhelming message of these passages. Well, one of the things that really hit me, I want to just kind of dig in a little bit just at the end to reflect on God's grace in this passage, because at the end of the day, it's not about how good of a guy Esau was or how bad of a guy Jacob is half the time. It's about God and His faithfulness in this situation and in our lives, in spite of our Jekyll moments, in spite of our bad relationships and the fear that we have. Only God's grace, His amazing grace through prayer, assaults fear and the flesh and brings reconciliation. God can reconcile even enemies through prayer. God can reconcile even enemies through prayer. It's incredible grace. It's impossible reconciliation. Horizontally, in the relationships, it's possible with God's grace. Reconciliation, horizontally, in your worst of relationships, is possible with God's grace. Why do I say that? Because reconciliation is a work of God in answer to prayer. Who is that person in your life, even that wretched unbeliever, you think? The one with whom you think reconciliation is impossible. Is it really impossible? Is that Jacob or Israel talking? Why? Because the moment we think it's impossible, when we think our marriage is doomed, there's no way out, when we think our family, that relationship with our family member is doomed, when we think that relationship with our the moment we think that it's impossible, we're forgetting grace. We're forgetting that the most impossible reconciliation, the one that trumps all of them eternally, has already occurred for you and for me in the gospel. That a dead sinner, 6 feet under, dead in trespasses and sin, could be made alive. to be seated in the family of God, to be called a saint, to be forgiven and completely righteous in Him, to have that, the eternal God of the universe be reconciled to us. That is the impossible in the gospel. And if we will hide in the gospel, the more we hide in the gospel, the more we will see that nothing is impossible with God from a horizontal standpoint. And we will hope for our marriage. And we will hope for our for the salvation of this person. We will hope for our boss. We'll hope for the next day, frankly. Because we understand and we're saturated in grace. Now, I think this is so God. This passage is so the Lord. I mean, to do this to Esau, I mean, it's Esau. And here Esau becomes the most unlikely character for the gospel I've ever run into in my studies. Unless the donkey can be somehow typologically worked with. I don't know. I've never tried it. So here we have Esau. Esau runs, arms open, hugs, and weeps. Ringing a bell? What do you think Jesus was thinking? Come on, what does it make you think of? It makes you think, for me at least, and I'll show you this, it makes me think of Luke chapter 15. Turn to Luke chapter 15. And look at verse 18. Now, verse 4 again of our passage, as you're turning to Luke 15, 18, then Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him and they wept. Luke 15, verse 18. And I will get up. I'm sick of myself. I will get up. I will go to my father. I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me one of your hired men. So he got up and came to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him, and he ran. And he embraced, literally fell on his neck. Same exact phrase in the LXX. Him and kissed him. Ran, embraced, and kissed him, and the son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his slaves, quickly, bring out the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and sandals on his feet, and bring the fattened calf. Kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and has come to life again. He was lost, but he has been found. And they began to celebrate. And so here is Esau, running with arms open to receive Jacob, picturing the father and the prodigal son. Same order of words. Many commentators, including me, are convinced that Jesus had this passage on his mind, especially in light of the grace that's all over the place in this passage and the idea of impossible reconciliation in its context. So I think when things are impossible horizontally and our relationships fill us with fear, dread, posturing, scheming, buy-off, payout, works, when that's happening, when we're thinking that things are impossible, then we're not believing the gospel of grace as much as we could. For those who have received God's grace may be confident that reconciliation is possible and that they will be protected. And this has a lot to do with that marriage of yours or with the church member that you're struggling with or with your children or all of your relationships. You know, I've been struck lately by a man named Louis Zamperini. Louis Zamperini was a POW in Japan. He was tortured by a very cruel man. And when he got out, he was cursed with flashbacks and nightmares. And he went to the bottle to drown his sorrows away. And his marriage went down the drain. And he was at the end of the rope. In fact, all he lived for was finding a ticket to Japan to kill this man. Because he was at large. Until grace found him. God found him and he was born again. 40 years passed. Near the end of his life, he found out that this man was alive. And he wanted to see him. He wanted to forgive him. He wanted to give him the gospel. He was filled with love for him. Because he had vertical grace. And hiding in that grace, these impossible relationships, the impossible happened. The impossible. And we have been given reconciliation in the gospel, and we have been given the ministry of reconciliation in the gospel. And so we have this horizontal possibility of giving that gospel which brings people to Christ. And we know that we can love the brothers, even in the church, even the annoying ones, even the ones that are hard to deal with, and especially those in the power of the gospel. And no relationship is past God's reconciling power. We have every reason to stop being afraid in these horizontal relationships. We have every reason in the gospel to speak the truth to people and not deceive them and trust God. We have every reason to obey all the way out of gratitude, trusting God. We have every reason, because we have experienced God's grace, His incredible grace and reconciliation. And so let us live out the grace of reconciliation in our relationships. Do you? I don't think we really believe that God can do verse 4. And so we're busy doing verses 5 through 11. We just are. And I think that is the message. God can do anything, and He will. And you say, that's going to be impossible. I'm going to get brutalized. He will protect you all the way until you reach the promised land, and you might even find out that the 400 men were actually meant to help you at the end of the day. Do we really believe the often repeated hymn, through many dangers, toils, and snares, I have already come. 'Tis grace hath brought me safe thus far, and grace will lead me home.